This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Good evening. Tonight, dinosaurs. I have here, sitting in the studio next to me, an elk. I'm sorry, an elk. Mrs. An Elk.
Miss.
Miss An Elk, who is an expert
no,
on
no,
the...
No, an elk.
What?
An elk, not an expert.
No, I was saying that you, Miss Elk, were an A-N, not A-N-N-E expert.
Oh.
On elks. I'm sorry, on dinosaurs.
Yes, I certainly am, Chris. How very true, my word, yes.
Now, Miss Elk, Anne, you have a new theory about the brontosaurus.
Can I just say here, Chris, for one moment, that I have a new theory about the brontosaurus?
Exactly. What is it?
Where?
No. What is your theory?
Oh, what is my theory?
Yes.
Oh, what is my theory that it is? Yes. Well, you may well ask, what is my theory?
I am asking.
And well, you may. Yes, my word, you may well ask what it is, this theory of mine. Well, this theory that I have, that is to say, which is mine, is mine.
I know it's yours. What is it?
Where? Oh, what is my theory?
Yes.
Ah, my theory that I have follows the lines that I am about to relate.
Our director assures me today's Fresh Air will go smoother than the program we just heard. Next week, the film Fierce Creatures opens, reuniting the team that made A Fish Called Wanda, including John Cleese and Michael Palin, who originally worked together on Monty Python's Flying Circus. We're bringing together four of the Pythons in back-to-back interviews on this archive edition of the show. Monty Python's Flying Circus made TV shows for 3.5 years on the BBC, creating a new style of sketch comedy that was sometimes literary, sometimes slapstick, often surreal. We start with a 1987 interview with Terry Jones. Jones wrote for the group and performed. He also directed the Python film The Life of Brian, a spoof of biblical epics about a Christ-like character. Terry Jones often played female roles, and in The Life of Brian, he played Brian's mother. In this scene, she's breaking the news to Brian that he's not really one of the chosen people.
Well, Brian, your father isn't Mr. Cohen.
I never thought he was.
No, none of your cheek. He was a Roman, Brian. He was a centurion in the Roman army.
You mean you were raped?
Oh, at first, yes.
Who was it?
Nordius Maximus, his name was. Promised me the known world, he did. I was to be taken to Rome, housed by the forum, slaves, asses' milk, as much gold as I could eat.
You know, I've always wondered, watching the Monty Python TV shows and also movies like The Life of Brian, how come each member of the cast was never identified with the characters that they played?
Well, I suppose it really came about because when we started doing Python, we very much felt ourselves as being an ensemble group. And we were sort of, we didn't really want to identify ourselves as individuals. The whole thing was to try and keep the, you know, Python as a group thing together. And I suppose that just sort of carried on through with the films. And I suppose the other reason is that, I mean, everybody played about, you know, far too many parts. If you started identifying them, I mean, you know, you had Mike Palin in Life of Brian playing about 16 parts or something. It'd be a never-ending list.
How would you describe the types of roles that you played when you were with Monty Python?
I describe them as the roles that nobody else would play, basically. I think that was the thing they had in common. That's really why I end up doing all the women, because the others got fed up with playing women. So, mark you, my voice does tend to go up rather easily. It's the way the Welsh, you know. We sort of started trying to, as we went on, we started trying to cast against type in a way and sort of, do things that we were, you know, that's maybe John, a part that John would naturally do, we'd give to Mike, and a part that Mike would naturally do, we'd give to me or Eric or something like that. We tried to mix it up, actually.
You did straight men a lot, didn't you?
I tended to in the TV shows, yes. I got a bit more outrageous as things went on, actually, when I sort of ended up doing, I think in Meaning of Life, I was Mr. Creosote. That's the fat man in the restaurant who explodes. And things like... My favourite part, actually, was the woman who had 60 children in the Every Sperm is Sacred song. That was, I think, my favourite role.
So you say you got the role of playing women because nobody else wanted it?
That was roughly it, actually, yes.
Was there a certain kind of woman that you had in mind when you would take on those roles?
Well, We were sort of doing sort of, I suppose I was doing sort of middle-aged, sort of rather ratty middle-aged rat bags, I suppose. But the awful thing is they always came out like looking like my mum. I mean, they didn't sound like my mum, but they certainly looked, I looked a spitting image of my mum when I had a scarf on and curlers on and things.
You wouldn't tell her that, would you?
No. Whether she spotted it or not, I don't know.
You did a lot of writing for Monty Python, right? Mm-hmm. What are some of the favourite sketches that you wrote?
That I wrote? Gosh, I tell you what, it's terribly difficult to remember because it all merges into a sort of, uh-huh. you can't tell which is which. I remember writing the Lumberjack sketch with Mike. And
the Lumberjack song?
Yes.
Oh, that's one of my favourites.
It was one of those moments. There's very few things that you can actually remember the moment of writing, but that one, we'd been struggling with the sketch all day. There was a sketch about this psychopathic barber who kept on wanting to stab his patients. And I remember sort of at the end saying, we can't finish this sketch. Let's have a song. We never get out with a song. So Mike and I just sort of sat down and wrote the Lumberjack song, sort of line by line kind of thing.
Could you sing some of it?
Well, I think it goes, I can't remember, how does it go? Oh, I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night and I work all day. I cut down trees, I skip and jump. I like to press wildflowers. On Wednesday I go shopping and hang around in bars.
I cut down trees, I skip and jump. He likes to press wildflowers. He puts on women's clothing and acts in bars.
I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night. Cut down trees, I wear high heels, suspenders and a bra. I wish I'd been a girly, just like my dear papa.
What was your approach to writing? Would you just sit around and free associate?
Yeah, it's a bit like that. I mean, it was very much sort of 9 till 5 job, you know, Terry, sort of getting up, sitting in front of a blank piece of paper and trying to sort of have some inspiration. Usually, I don't know where it comes from. I remember with the Mr. Creosote sketch, I remember sitting down with a blank piece of paper and writing at the top, a sketch in the worst possible taste. And then the sketch came out of that, really. But I didn't know what it was going to be when I started off. Generally, our system used to be that we used to write individually. We'd write in pairs. I mean, I wrote with Mike Palin most of the time. But as we went on, it was very much Mike and I would write separately. Then we'd meet together, the two of us, read out what we've got, criticise, maybe swap over what we'd got and so carry on where the other one had left off. Kind of like consequences, really. And then after a couple of weeks writing, we'd maybe meet up with a group and then read out what we'd written to the group. And then there'd be the same sort of interchange would go on with sort of criticism and swapping over.
When you were with Monty Python, you first started to get into directing, which you're doing more of now. Remember all those film inserts in Monty Python for the TV show? Did you direct those?
No. What happened was that, I suppose when Mike and I sort of, one of the reasons why we got into performing was that we originally started as writers on television, and we gradually began to realise that, you know, that we'd write things and then they'd be done, weren't being done how we wanted them to be done. So we started performing things as well. And as we got into the performance, we gradually realised how crucial the direction was as well. Like, it was absolutely crucial to have the right locations. I remember one example in a series that we wrote, or that we were in, called The Complete and Utter History. This was just before Python. And we'd written, it was a lot of it on film, And we were doing this scene, which was meant to be the Battle of Harfleur or something, the English versus the French. And we had the French just as onion sellers with striped jerseys and, you know, berets and French loaves and onions on their bicycles. That was the French army kind of thing. It was pretty sort of crude stuff. But the whole point of the writing of it was we staged it like... you know, they appeared on the horizon. We wanted a cliff, you know, with them to appear on the horizon like the Indians at some sort of in some western or something. And we got to this location. It's all sort of gentle rolling hills with forests, and you couldn't do the shot, you know. And we're saying, what are we doing here? This is not, we can't do it. And, you know, we had to shoot it, but you know, it made the thing look very much weaker than it was actually. Than it, you lost the parody in it. So it was gradually this realization that everything was crucial in comedy, you know, the location, the costumes, the makeup, as well as who's acting it and who's and what they're saying. Everything's crucial. It's more like poetry, I always feel. So when we actually came to doing Python, I was by this stage sort of very keen to sort of keep an eye on what the director was doing. And we had a very good director, Ian McNaughton. But it was a bit of a struggle to begin with because it's, you know, it's like, you know, I was infringing on his territory, sort of always keeping an eye on where the camera was and everything. But as the series went on, it began to get much easier and we began to work much better together.
You know, I figured that all of you who were in Monty Python probably came from very straight-laced, goal-oriented, disciplined, middle-class families. Is that right?
Yes, I suppose so.
Except that what about you?
Things tend not to be quite so goal-orientated in England. It's not quite the same as over here. But certainly sort of very straight middle-class, lower middle-class families. My dad was a bank clerk, and so I grew up in a household where we never had any money. There was we never had a car, for example. So it was kind of genteel poverty, if you like, trying to keep up an appearance of respectability.
You went to Oxford, though, didn't you?
Yes.
How did you get there? Isn't that a very expensive school?
No, it's all free in England. I mean, it probably won't be much longer with Mrs. Thatcher around, but up till now, it's all been free.
You had planned on becoming an English teacher, right?
Well, not really. I sort of grew up being a poet, really, from the age of about 7 onwards. I was always going to be a poet, actually, Terry.
Oh, okay.
And, but then I found that, you know, sort of grammar school, rather sort of... educates you out of being a poet. You know, the one thing they do teach you is there's no money in poetry. I learned this lesson. And the only thing, you know, I could possibly see myself qualified for doing after sort of, you know, all that schooling was teaching, well, you know, becoming an academic of some sort. But then when I was at Oxford, I realised I was sitting in the Bodleian Library, which is this beautiful old library that was built about sort of 500 years ago. I was sitting in this library and I suddenly looked up and I was getting really angry about what somebody had written, about what somebody else had written, about what Milton had written. And I suddenly looked around and looked at everybody else sort of sitting there and thinking, how many people else are getting worked up about this? And I suddenly thought, I don't want to do this. Maybe when I'm 60, but at the moment I'd rather write the thing in the first place. So it was a kind of a moment of decision when I thought, I'm going to start writing stuff for myself rather than writing commentaries about what other people are writing, what other people are writing about what somebody else has written about.
Did that lead you into comedy, this realization?
Yes, I suppose it did. Again, it's kind of accident in a way. I was involved in what we call a review, which is kind of like a show with sort of sketches and songs and things. And we did these, a group of us from Oxford, do them in Edinburgh at the Edinburgh Festival. And then when I came down after 3 years, we got an offer to do this show that we'd been doing in Edinburgh in London for about 6 weeks. So I sort of eased into it that way. Never ever sort of really thinking that's what I was going to make my livelihood out of.
But you had met, I guess, Michael Palin in Oxford. Were you the core group of Monty Python? Were you the two who organized it?
Well, it kind of happened like I met Mike at Oxford, and we didn't actually write very much there together. But we did, after Mike came down, we started working and writing stuff for the BBC. We were then offered to do a TV show and actually appear in it, a TV show for children called Do Not Adjust Your Set. And... It was involving Eric Idle, and Terry Gilliam then turned up when we were making these shows and did a couple of cartoons for us. So that was a kind of core group. There was me, Michael Palin, Eric Idle, and then Terry Gilliam came along. And when John Cleese and Graham Chapman said, how about doing something together to Mike and me? Well, we said, all right, well, can we bring Eric and Terry Gilliam along? And that's really how Python happened. It was always very much a sort of an anarchist sort of collective, you know. And six of us there, you know, working together and writing equally, which again goes back to your first question about why we didn't actually sort of, you know, identify ourselves. It was very much sort of immersing ourselves in a group.
Terry Jones recorded in 1987. This is Fresh Air.